FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 12/20/17. Well, the year is almost gone. You're going to definitely want to email me after you hear who is going to be on the show today. And that's a really simple thing to do. Email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. The Twitter feed's at Kerry Lutz. So without further ado, I'm really blessed and honored to have Dr. Ron Paul with us today. And he's ambassador for Goldco and Coin IRA. Dr. Paul, welcome to the show.
Kerry, thank you. Nice to be with you.
Hey, and like I told you pre-call, I've been an admirer of yours for many years, the only sensible, sane voice in the U.S. Congress, and courage, bravery. You stood up for what you believed in. You wouldn't compromise. And that's probably why you're not sitting in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue today, Dr. Paul.
Well, who knows? I think a country has to be ready for the changes to come about. I believe I've contributed something to moving us in a direction where someday we will have, you know, the results of the revolution, a revolutionary movement toward liberty and restoring what the founders tried to do. But I still think there's a lot of work for us to do for people like you who are doing podcasting and changing people's minds and people understanding, because if Washington is not ready, it's like hitting your head against a brick wall. And I think that things are changing for the better, not in Washington. They still reflect the old school, and the politics require all the spending and all the special interests. I think people, the ones I meet with, even on college campuses, which are not controlled completely, by Bernie Sanders people, there's a lot of young people that we see and talk to. And I think that philosophically, we're making great inroads, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Hey, in your new book, and again, Dr. Ron Paul is with us, The Revolution at 10 Years, and in it, you chronicle the fate and future of liberty in the U.S. So looking at the last election, because it's still on all of your minds, I mean, it was big. We got Donald Trump, for better or for worse, but we didn't get a Washington insider. How do you explain that one? What's your feeling about it?
Well, I go back and forth, because someday I think that's absolutely the case. But then there are other times when the campaign rhetoric of the president is quite a bit different than what he's doing. He looked like he was going to change things dramatically on foreign policy. But then once again, it seems like there's still a lot of influence by the neocons. And spending continues. The militarism continues. We're still have a big presence overseas, and we're very much involved. So I don't, I haven't made up my mind completely on that, how much of a challenge it is to the deep state, because I think whether we like to admit it or not, the deep state has so much influence. So even that individual that might be willing to stand up to it, it's probably a difficult situation. And maybe that's what gives us this questionable attitude toward Trump, him saying he wants to do one thing, but it's not accomplished. But I think the power of the deep state is very, very strong, and that's one of the reasons why we don't see the changes that we had hoped for.
Yeah, well, look, any president comes into office, the first thing he's got to do is consolidate his power. And the deep state, as well as the prior administration, and maybe it's one and the same, fought him every step of the way, is still fighting him now. In spite of that, look, he got rid of about 1,600 regulations his first year. I know that isn't revolutionary, perhaps, but in the scope of it and the fact that no one ever did it before who went to Washington, so many presidents said they're going to cut back the power of the state and rein in the administrative state. He's made a little bit of progress, more than anyone else.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that's why the markets are doing very well. I think that's why Wall Street's doing pretty well, because those are good signs and good signals going on. The bigger picture of the spending, I think, is what we have to face up to. But I think the country is, what seems to be a disconnect is I always believe people vote from their bellies, whether they have a job or not, whether they feel good economically. It seems like there's a lot of signs that, you know, there are more jobs and more people are doing better, the stock market's up, but still there's this bifurcation of the lower one half of the country keeps getting poorer and poorer. I saw a statistic yesterday that showed that homelessness had gone back up last year for the first time in 7 years. So we still have major problems. Almost 600,000 people still live on our streets, and it's moving in the direction of moving upward. So I think the situation of over 50, 60 years of a monetary system and an economic system really has divided us into two groups. And I think that definitely the economy is a lot happier with Trump so far. It's amazing that he doesn't get more credit for it, because I think that's what people are looking for. But the only way I can explain it is that there's still a lot of people that don't get counted. You know, the labor participation rate stays very high. And I think this is characteristic of what happens in an economy run by fiat money and a Federal Reserve system. If you undermine the value of a currency, you usually wipe out the middle class and you get more poor people, but then another group of people benefit. And that's why I always go back to monetary policy and spending as an equalizer, because the more you see this discrepancy between the rich and the poor, the more difficult these problems are going to be. Now, let's say so far Trump's done all right and a lot of people are going to do a lot better, but if it isn't spread out like a market should do it, then there's going to be more greater anger. And I think that's what's giving some energy to the cultural Marxists. I mean, they're able to stir up a lot of trouble. I see them as a great threat, but I see it also as a long-term consequence of a monetary system and an economic system that we have tolerated for too long.
Yeah, for way too long. Hey, election night, when you were watching the returns, assuming you were you surprised that Trump won?
Well, everybody knew. I always considered it very, very close. I didn't think he would win, but it wasn't like, that I didn't think it was possible. A lot of people, the Democrats were pretty shocked. I mean, I think I got a kick out of that. Yeah. They just couldn't believe it. They still don't believe it. You know, they're still in shock. But no, it was a pretty amazing night. And you wonder, that's one step where you might say that the deep state didn't have as much control as they thought they had, because the media and all the establishment were, you know, opposed to them. So in that sense, it was a pretty exciting night.
I wasn't surprised. I knew he was going to win, because I knew in Florida he was going to win. Once he got the Cuban vote, it was kind of all over for Hillary here. And he also got a big chunk of the Haitian vote. Well, so let's go back to the Democratic primary season. I have a theory about it. They all say that it was rigged and Bernie, you know, it was taken away from him. I think Bernie joined the fray knowing that it was rigged, knowing that he didn't have a chance, and accepting that to get his message out or for personal profit, whatever the case may be. And then he found out after entering it what a weak candidate Hillary was, and that he actually had a chance, perhaps, but that he joined this thing. He was part of the rigging. He wasn't a hapless victim.
Yeah, well, I think that's plausible. The one thing is, you know, the media, the people we have to listen to so much, talk about, you know, this tremendous dissension and split in the Republican Party, which is true. You have the Trump side of it, and then you have, McConnell and the establishment Republican. And so it's almost like two parties. Just look at that race in Alabama. You know, you could see the division. But that's all you hear is about the split in the Republican Party. But what about in the Democratic Party? You have the Bernie Sanders and the progressives, and they, some of the progressives I work with, because they are civil libertarians and they have a more restrained foreign policy. But if you look at the division, if you take this, Bernie Sanders was not a true blue progressive. But let's say he represented the progressives and have this different element. That is exactly opposite of Hillary. Hillary. Hillary was, you know, a neocon, and I even made a statement before the election. You know, the neocons could run her as a Republican if they wanted to, because she was, you know, tied into Wall Street and all this other thing. So I think there's a tremendous division there, and how Bernie Sanders made his decisions as he moved along, I have no idea. But I think they have a split, and of course there's a split in the Republican Party, and that's why it's a bit chaotic right now.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. And yeah, I thought the split was much worse because the media totally bypassed the internecine at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. They were abusing these Bernie supporters. They were banishing them, and they were really mistreating them, like, unbelievably. And then they were projecting to the world this whole unified front. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Hey, switching over to economics. So we both share an affinity, a belief in the Austrian School of Economics. And it appears that through the internet and through opening of minds, Austrian economics has made more of an inroad than might have been expected. Is it going to keep a pace, or is it just going to be a passing fad or fancy for the younger people who've gotten into it?
No, I think it's going to keep improving and in acceptance by more and more people. I think that's where I'm the most optimistic. I got involved in politics in the early 1970s, over the monetary issue and the breakdown of the Bretton Woods and the things that the Austrian school had predicted. And but when I first went to Congress in 76, nobody had the vaguest idea, even hardly the word libertarian. Didn't know. They couldn't quite figure out what my vote were all about and why I voted certain things on economic policy. But now I think it's advanced tremendously. Just think of the work of the Mises Institute and the other various groups. There's a lot of great groups out there. So intellectually, I think that we're having a greater influence. And I think that when the young people are offered this, they realize there's something wrong. And most people think, well, they're all going to follow Bernie Sanders, which I do not believe. But that's easily understood, because that's what they have been conditioned by their professors to more likely go along with, socialism and welfareism, the government taking care of them. But I think that, the Austrian school and libertarianism is out there and growing. And the other thing is, it's not a pure numbers game. You know, you need 8 or 10% of the people who are dedicated to some principles and influencing the masses on these ideas, and then they eventually change, and they change the people in Washington. A minor example of this is when we did a lot of work on getting the audit the Fed bill, passed in the House of Representatives, just to make the point we ought to look at the Fed. Well, that wasn't done by me giving speeches on the House floor or lobbying my fellow members. It was done by going to the grassroots and waking up the people, and they called their congressmen. So you can do it, and I think that's what's happening. But once again, it's an overwhelming task, because by far and large, the large majority of people like welfareism and warfareism and the military-industrial complex, all these things, there's so many special interests, but it's going to come to an end because we're going broke and we won't be able to afford all that, and then they're going to have to look for something. So the big challenge will be, what are we going to replace this mess with? And hopefully it will be with sound money and Austrian type of economic policy and a different role for government. We have decided that the role of government is there for one precise purpose, and that is to protect our liberties and let the people alone and let the rest of the world alone and not police the world. So it's not very complex, but when you're broke, sometimes you have to accept these things, and all empires come to an end. It's usually when they overextend overseas, and our empire is weakening, a lot of cracks, so we need to prepare for presenting the alternatives, and fortunately, people like you understand Austrian economics and help promote exactly what that's all about and why freedom is so much better than government management and bureaucracy. You already mentioned the wonderful aspect of eliminating a lot of regulation. Well, there's a lot more we need to regulate too, and we need to investigate things like the Federal Reserve.
Absolutely. So the empire is coming to an end. Is it going to go out with a whimper, or a bang?
No, it'll be a big one. It'll be gradual and steady and an erosion. I think it'll be very, very difficult, and there's going to be a lot of anger and a lot of problems. But sometimes empires end more calmly. The British Empire, you know, didn't go overnight, even though after World War One and World War Two, they lost control of the reserve currency of the world, and gradually their empire shrunk. And it wasn't militaristic. I think it was wonderful the way the Soviet Empire ended. It went out pretty calmly. But I think there's going to be a lot of disruption and anger. And this one will be more significant because never has a country managed a fiat currency that became a worldwide currency and a reserve currency. So it's going to affect a lot of people. And then there's going to be a greater clamor for protectionism and for tariffs and all these things that will make things worse. And that is why the ideas of free markets have to be understood so people know why you're doing it. If they don't see some benefit, they're not going to accept it. But when a system is totally failing, then they're much more open. Well, maybe we better look at something else rather than just looking for another tyrant to take over.
Hey, and that's a great point. You know, the other thing is that most people in society don't understand the costs, the true costs, when you go anti-market, when you don't let the market work its equalizing force, its power for growth. The average person out there in America today really is clueless about how much the government really costs, not just in terms of taxes, deficits, but the opportunity cost of the current system, not allowing people to follow their dreams and really to be the best they can. I think that's a real failing on the part of the media, but perhaps upon the people who are proposing a better system than what we have, because until you really understand the costs of the present system, you don't really understand the damage that it's inflicting.
You know, and I think that's so true because that's the whole purpose of the monetary system. There's always a cost, but if you can delay it or hide it or shift it from one group to another, it can last longer. So inflation fits, satisfy the people who like big government because if they collected revenues to finance welfare and our militarism every single year, it would end quickly. We can't afford this. We have no money left. But if you can borrow the money because we're strong militarily and have a strong economy and a strong currency, you know, and can go out and borrow and print a lot of money, then we can delay it. And then we can shift it from the wealthy to the cost will go to the middle class. And that, of course, is why the cost is going into the middle class whose prosperity is dwindling. And it is hidden, but it is the destruction of money, and it does it. And they do it on purpose. They can tax, but they can't get enough money. They can borrow, but there's a limit to that, pushes interest rates up. But then they have to resort to the debasement of currency, which is one of the most evil things a government can do to its people because it's legalized counterfeit and it's theft. And a lot of people who know how to get influence in government, and that's why lobbying is a pretty big business, huge, and everybody is involved because they're always trying to hide the real cost of government, and people think government is free because they come up with a problem and say, let government take care of it, and they never say, who's the government? Where's it coming from? Will this hurt me? Well, you can't prove to these people that it's going to hurt them tomorrow because someone will say, no, I just got something for free. I get free housing and free medical care and all this stuff, so they can't see this. When in a bankruptcy, they have to become more realistic, but it's hidden costs, I think, which is a big issue.
Yeah, a lot of hidden costs and a lot of hidden damage that I guess will eventually come to the forefront. So as far as foreign policy goes, what should we be doing in the rest of the world? Should we just pull out all of our bases in all the foreign countries of the world, bring the soldiers back to here and call it a day? Mm-hmm. Do we have a role in foreign affairs?
Yeah, I will go ahead and answer, but I think I have to leave, you know, after because my time is running out.
Not a problem.
But no, I'm a strict non-interventionist. The founders advise that. Stay out of entangling affairs of other nations, internal affairs of other nations. Be friends with all nations, trade with them. And I would say, even in our early history, they didn't always follow those rules, I would say it's very, very attractive. We ought to mind our own business, and we ought to have a strong national defense. We ought to have a strong economy. We ought to set a high standard. I think there is something to be said that we should spread American exceptionalism, but not the way it's done. You can't spread exceptionalism with a gun and say, you will have elections. Then we go in and rig their elections, and then we get into this big squabble about who's rigging or who's involved in our elections. But no, we get involved in just about everything around the world because we are maintaining our power. And no, if anybody dare not suggest that we shouldn't, they wouldn't want to use the dollar like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, you know what happens to them. And right now, of course, China's talking about the same thing. People, they don't like that. But I think what we should do is have a strong defense, but we should stay out of these entangling alliances. I like what Trump said about get out of these organizations. We don't need NATO, and we don't, but he's involved now in trying to control NATO. And I just think we should come home. And that's what the Russians, the Soviets had to do. They went home, and there was, there might have been 15 countries that they had control of, and they just, lost control of that. It happened quickly. So what in the world do we put bases and weapons in Eastern Europe? What if that was done to us in Mexico?
Oh, yeah.
We would do it. What if we had the Chinese Navy in the Gulf of Mexico telling us what to do? But we go over there in the South China Sea and we want to do this. No matter, people get a little bit annoyed with us. So I'm a strong believer in non-intervention and a strong military defense of our country.
Hey, and one quick last question, because I know you have to go, Dr. Paul. Cryptocurrencies, any opinion, positive, negative?
Well, it's not money as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't fit the definition of money. The Austrian school teaches that money has to originate in the marketplace. And so far throughout 6,000 years of history, it's always been something or a substitute for that thing, like a certificate. But the cryptocurrency doesn't fit that bill. And I don't think it will replace real money. But right now, there's a lot of people making a lot of money off cryptocurrencies. But I suspect that you'll see a sudden change in that attitude in the not too distant future.
Well, Dr. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the book, The Revolution at 10 Years, and it's your chronicles of the fate and future of liberty in the U.S. Also, don't hesitate to check out Dr. Paul's site. It's ronpaulinstitute.org. Dr. Paul, wish you the best of luck on the book. Keep up the fight, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Nice to be with you. Bye-bye.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.